name is Anthony Marco, and welcome to TV ABCs, where we have conversations about Canadian television before cameras, before cuts, before channels, and explore how the people behind your favorite shows are being creative. This week, Jonathan Torrance. Just over the past couple years alone, in addition to winning a Canadian Screen Award playing Robert Sheely on Mr. D, he was also the host of Wipeout Canada and TV with TV's Jonathan Torrance on TV Tropolis. He was also part of the multi-award-winning sitcom Call Me Fitz for HBO Canada. Before that, Torrance was seen as Gerald on Spike TV's popular reality show parody Joe Schmo 2. Hosting stints include both The Kids Are in Charge for the Travel Channel US and Popularity Contest for CMT US, as well as co-anchoring and reporting on Reality Remix, Fox's reality channel's daily flagship show, and making frequent appearances on the E! Network's popular 50 Most Clip shows. He's been dropping rhymes for years as J-Rock on the infectious Trailer Park Boys. His work on five seasons of Jonavision earned a total of 7 Gemini Award nominations. Oh, and there was about a decade's worth of street sense that everyone growing up in 90s Canada remembers. He's currently also hosting a podcast with Jeremy Taggart called Canadianity. And now my conversation with Jonathan Torrance. By the way, congratulations on last night.
Thank you so much.
As we're recording, it's now, I don't know the date this is officially going to get released, but last night, the Canadian Screen Awards, you held up the banner for CBC, winning for Mr. D. So was that a surprise to you, or how far in advance did they let you know that stuff?
Well, when the envelope opens and they read your name, that's when you find out. I have lost so many times that really when people open their mouth in years past, what I've heard is, not you, Jonathan, sit down, and the winner is anyone but you, Jonathan. It is an honor to be nominated, it's true. It is a thrill to hear your name read aloud, it really is. And I wish it meant less than it does. I've been, in the time since, trying to understand why it was such an honor and such a thrill. But I think it was two reasons. One, nice to be recognized by your peers, of course. But two, standing up on that stage, looking around at the room and surveying the current state of things.
Yeah.
It's easy when you have your head down to feel like we're in a bad way, or there's no hope for the future, or where are we as an industry. But you look around and see some Orphan Blackses and some Rick Mercerses and some Priestleys and some Amazing Race Canada folks. It's not so bad.
No, I mean, everyone's calling this the golden age of television, aren't they?
It kind of feels that way. And even if you kind of take a moment to look at comedy, which is kind of where I tend to mow my grass, as I said in my speech, 3 of the 5 nominees were shot in Nova Scotia. I think I hold the distinction of being the only actor who's worked on all 3. And comedy, the state of comedy is pretty robust right now, with Sunnyside on City and the Bruce McCullough Show, whatever the future of Spun Out may be, Mr. D, Schitt's Creek. It feels like one of the things that struck me is for the networks to be competitive is expected, but for them to be supportive and kind of work together on things like Fan Zone as part of the Canadian Screen Week, as much as I don't want to go to Fan Zone as a fan or as a person sitting behind the table, I really dig that they're working together on doing that. Because if they don't support each other, we're just a bunch of shows. If everybody supports each other, we're an industry. And if one show does well, that's good for everybody. And I've never understood why people don't necessarily get that.
It seems like you're at a point, not you personally, but I mean the networks are at a point where they've got to keep trying something. It's not always going to work. It's just like shows. Not every show is going to work, and not every strategy is going to work. But the year that you don't do anything is the year that it looks like you've given up. And like I said, with the list of shows that you just mentioned, 3 or 4 years ago, there were a lot more misses than there were hits, so to speak. And
right,
I mean, it's so much a matter of timing, it seems. I mean, you've been doing comedy shows now for how long, and how many of them are hits and how many of them are misses? And you've had to have ridden a pretty long roller coaster at this point to realize that some things catch and some things just don't.
Well, the unintentional comedies are the ones that hurt the most. The ones that folks have rebranded as comedies that weren't meant to be. I think that's why, I mean, Trailer Park Boys is an obvious but great example. If it's good enough and compelling enough and funny enough, people will find it. Nobody knew what Showcase was when Trailer Park Boys started. John Doyle gave the most blistering, heinous review of Trailer Park Boys When It Bowed that I've ever read to this day. In fairness, a year later, he did a full I'm so sorry, I was wrong, this show is great, which was awfully cool of him.
Right.
But I think that's why I savor something like Trailer Park Boys Landing, because I've worked on enough things that haven't. And it was a great example that if it's funny and good, people will find it. It doesn't matter where. And I think if you're an executive in this country, obviously there are fiscal challenges, but really to a degree, your job is twofold. One is risk management. So if a Schitt's Creek comes across your desk, you can tell your bosses later, well, look, it had Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara in a kind of tested and tried and true premise. Of course, I was going to roll the dice on that. But I think the other part of your job is to roll the dice on the Mark Littles of the world or some of the up-and-coming Hannah Cheesemans, writers who are trying things that are new and different. And, you know, it's like your stock portfolio. You do some blue-chip things, and then you do some high-risk things.
Do you think that a couple of the shows that we've mentioned so far are the result of networks finally taking some element of risk? Because one of the things that I know when Diane and I talk and Greg on the podcast, one of the things that we concern ourselves with is it seems like there is, if we're not talking about risk, there's certainly so many filters that especially it seems Canadian shows have to go through in order to get some kind of initial just kickstart to begin. I mean, we obviously don't have a system like pilot season down in the States where like they're going to shoot 200 shows and pick 15 out of that. But it seems like there's so many filters and so much risk aversion here that a lot of stuff just doesn't even get to that point where anyone thinks it's going to see the light of day.
But that's where technology has become the great equalizer. And I'm late to the technology party, but I know that if I have a great idea, I can get a camera and grab my friend and bang something out and put it on YouTube.
Right.
And it maybe has just as much a chance of getting discovered and recognized as anything else. I mean, does the pilot season in L.A. work?
Oh, yeah.
Like, they might green light 15 of those shows, but 12 of them are still going to get killed.
Yeah.
I know that the one thing that I know for sure is, especially with comedy, it has to be somebody's vision, and if it tries to be everybody's vision, it stops being anything to anyone. I'd rather work on a show that's everything to some than just something to everyone.
Yeah, because comedy in every way is always going to be niche to some degree. The idea that you're going to hit a comedy show out of the park with a wide demographic is rare these days.
Right, and maybe that is more American. Maybe that is more portly husband and unreasonably attractive wife, ABC style. But I can tell you one thing, on Call Me Fitz, the color of Jason Priestley's shoes was decided by Sherry Elwood, and she was right, and people just knew that.
Yeah.
And as far as a showrunner who micromanaged, and I say that in a great way, what her vision was, the network didn't interfere, the actors didn't interfere, the departments were there to service her idea, and look at the end result. It was genius.
Do you find with many of the shows you've been on, does that seem to be a success formula for you, for the shows, is that at some point everyone who could throw in their two cents decides that they're going to back off a bit and say, at what level do you have to have that level of trust? Is it usually right off the first episode of the first season, or does that trust usually build to where, okay, we've got a season under our belts, we're just going to trust now that the show is going to do what it's going to do and people are going to back off of it?
You know, I hadn't considered that, but now that you mention it, when I think about Fitz, when I think about Trailer Park, when I think about Mr. D, there's no question as to whose vision it is. Jerry comes from a stand-up background. Stand-up is a very solo endeavor, as you know. Making a TV show is, in theory, a very team-oriented sport. The thing that I really enjoy about working with Jerry is he's not encumbered by the things that some of us who've been around in TV a really long time would be. You know, we're so motivated by getting the day, shooting a number of pages, getting through the script, keeping on schedule, no overtime. Jerry is not afraid to say, guys, but the joke isn't working. It's not funny yet, so we can't move on. And that's been a really important lesson to be reminded of. Same with Mike Clattenburg doing a Trailer Park Boys scene. It would be really funny. It's good, and the scene's moving along nicely. But he wouldn't move on until he discovered that if you give Randy a bag of sour cream and onion chips, same scene, same words, for some reason that just takes it to a whole new stratosphere of funny.
I was just going to say it's a matter of where you can't. There's a great realization there after doing it, even for a short period of time, that no amount of editing is going to make this funny. We need the shot.
Right. Yeah. And especially, I always use the crew as a barometer. A lot of people think, well, you know, a crew is kind of lowest common denominator. It's kind of base humor. I'm always surprised when I hear people say that. My feeling is they've seen every trick in the book. So if you're engaging the crew and keeping them close and that they're paying attention, that you might be onto something, you know?
Yeah.
Trailer Park these days has been an anomaly because in the post-Clattenburg era, it's now a Netflix original, there isn't a network presence. There are no notes. They don't want to weigh in on, I don't think you should name that character Linda because I went to high school with a Linda and she was nothing like that. I mean, the joke about what network notes can sometimes be like, and that's an extreme example, but it's almost eerie because there's a natural bottleneck. You finish an outline, you send it off, you're waiting for notes, you start on another outline, you take the first script of draft, you get notes on that. This is, you finish the outline, and if you like it, you write it up.
Yeah.
And they want to see the show when it's finished on the condition that you're happy with it. And seemingly, they assume you're going to want to keep making the show until you tell them otherwise. So there's kind of this, like, waiting around to hear if you picked up thing. It's really kind of changed everything.
Now, when you think about this kind of change, obviously you talked about how you perceive yourself as coming late to the technology side of it. What do you see as... when I take a look at, I always go to the online Bibles of Wikipedia and IMDb when I'm talking with somebody, and I realize that they're not incredibly accurate, but it looks to me, and certainly correct me if I'm wrong, it looks to me like a lot of the stuff that you've done, especially over the past 10 to 15 years, has been stuff that seems to have been, in other words, if there wasn't a show on the go that you might have joined up with, you've been pretty active in saying, all right, something needs to be done. We're going to do this. In other words, you don't seem to have been embarrassed at starting up your own stuff at all, or pushing a new show or pushing a new thing. Having these online vehicles now, does it give you a sense of optimism that there's yet, you know, a new universe to tackle, so to speak?
I can credit/blame Los Angeles, California for everything that's happened to me in the last 10 years because I went down there out of self-imposed exile when I turned 30. I'd been at CBC for 15 years, working in kids' TV.
Right.
There was a feeling internally at CBC, though I wanted to just kind of do Jonovision, but later at night, because the audience that grew up watching it was now like me, kind of early 30s, there was a feeling I couldn't carry a show by myself.
Right.
Or people couldn't envision me as an adult performer. So I did the only thing I could think to do, which was go to L.A. Fortunately, the page turned from Jonovision to J-Rock happened, and then from J-Rock to Mr. Chile, and I think that's the difference between a role and a career. You have to be diverse here. In L.A., they want to know if you're a Schwimmer or a Seacrest, and you can't be both.
Or do you want to be either? Do you want to be either?
No, it's true. It was confounding to people when they'd say, so you're a host-ish, but you do sketch? Kind of. But you're stand-up? No. Are you an actor? Well, I have. They can't pin you down.
Yeah.
Those are all the things that you have to be in Canada. So I didn't like feeling like in the States I was at arm's length. I needed a manager and I needed an agent to get me access to a director to audition for a thing I didn't even want to do. So I made a lifestyle choice to move back here, and I had so much pent-up creativity. You can get to the networks in Canada. You'll probably get a no, but a yes is an honest yes.
Sure.
So I had so many things that I wanted to do when I moved back here that I was so excited by the access that I had again that I just didn't let it limit me as far as who I reached out to and what I suggested and what I pitched. And if I got no's or if I got that's a great idea, you should do it on YouTube, which is really what some of the networks are saying now. They're just being overt about it. We have no money. You should do that on the internet.
Yeah.
That's what I did.
And it seems, so, especially with Netflix now and Netflix, Amazon in the States, I mean, there's awards being given for the past 2 or 3 years now for content created specifically for online services. It's as somebody who has a bunch of ideas and wants to get new projects out there, it seems like this is a good thing. Although the model may be different, slightly different, ultimately it's a matter of seeing a creative vision get on the air, so to speak.
Well, it's trying, I guess, to get ahead a little bit of the technology, because when I lived in the States, they'd say, it's like the Daily Show, but for your phone, and we're looking for people to audition for it. And I remember thinking, nobody wants to watch a show that's sort of like the Daily Show on their phone. And by the time I'd finished uttering that sentence, people were able to actually watch the actual Daily Show on their actual phone.
Yeah.
So, I started a podcast a year ago with Jeremy Taggart, the former drummer from Our Lady Peace. I had always imagined that it would be with the end game of getting a radio show. And I had an epiphany in the last couple of months where I realized a radio show is limiting. People want to binge listen to six of these on the drive to their folks' cottage.
Yeah.
So it's how do I, like the message is the medium. It's backwards. How do I keep doing this podcast in my basement for a living?
Right.
And I know that certainly the way I pitch networks, where I used to pitch networks and say, here's the idea, can I have a bit of dough? I'll go out and shoot a thing, I'll bring it back. Now, especially with a comedy, you have to shoot a thing, because there is no tone font that you can submit your 2-page document on. So you have to suggest, this is what it looks, sounds, and smells like. And if they buy that, you're kind of protected because they know what they're getting from the get-go.
Yeah,
I try to delay network involvement as long as is humanly possible, because before you bring in extra cooks. Now, don't get me wrong, I've pitched 20 shows in the last 18 months, and I had a nibble on two.
Right.
And these are ideas that I know in my heart are great TV shows.
But it's, yeah, I understand what you're saying. And can I tell you how much I love what you just said about podcasting? Because
sure.
Being a podcaster myself, I cringe at when people start podcasting to get radio. Don't get me wrong, podcasting is a very young medium. It's underappreciated, not necessarily in terms of numbers, but in terms of just from a media literacy perspective on the things that make a podcast a great podcast versus the things that make radio great radio. People just aren't quite there yet, and I almost, even though, you know, all the people that loved Serial, let's say, and how it became this huge thing and things were written about it and all of that, to me, Serial was done like a radio show. It just happened to be delivered in a podcast form. Whereas I want to hear people who are embracing the podcast conventions, which I don't know if they've been fully written yet, but I mean, I love hearing people who just are doing stuff that couldn't be played on radio.
It was podcast listeners that taught me that lesson. In the early going of the podcast, I mean, it's only been a year, but in the early going of the podcast, we wanted to have guests, we wanted to have news stories that we'd kind of dissect. It was only through the reaction of folks listening and hearing that really what they're interested in is, Jeremy was a rock drummer. What do you do when you have to pee during a rock show? Like, how do you do that?
Yeah.
It was trusting our instinct and our own abilities to tell a story that in and of itself was kind of compelling enough. So there are kind of three things that people are responding to. One is Tales from the Road, kind of a peek behind the curtain in this blinding galaxy of star we call Canadian show business. Two is two guys that they've heard of before struggling with everyday mundane things. And the third is we've kind of stumbled upon this religion that we created called Canadianity, where really it's with a nostalgic bent. We're just remembering, like, remember Polka Dot Door?
Yeah.
Talking about all of the Canadian TV things that shaped us and discovering that for whatever reason there seems to be a hole in our, Canadianity these days.
And, like, I those connections are great because there are those Canadiana moments, you're right, that they become touchstones for a lot of us. For me, the touchstone that I always bring up on this podcast, and I drive Diane totally insane when we record, is Hilarious House of Frightenstein, because I live in Hamilton. But that's something that it's one of those things where a Canadian can lock down on that, and some people in the States can, but it's a very Canadian show. And it's somehow, it's somehow heartening these days to have venues to talk about the things that we have in common versus the things that tear us apart.
So under the umbrella category of celebrating Canadianity, this was a show I pitched. It's never going to happen, so I'll share it with you. This is a show that I pitched around town with my friend Rob Warsoff, who's a great TV producer from Montreal. It's called The Canadian. 12 would-be Canadians arrive in Halifax at Pier 21 aboard the Citizenship. These are all people who are in various stages of the immigration process. What they're competing for is to leapfrog the front of the line. In every province and territory, they compete in a regional stereotypical challenge, the canoe portage in Winnipeg, the Banff Pond Hockey Challenge, the Sugar Shack in Quebec. There's a town hall meeting in every province, and the locals vote on who best exemplifies what it means to be a Canadian. The person with the most votes gets to stay. In the end, the winner is awarded Canadian citizenship on the steps of Parliament Hill. But every challenge, the prize is a million Aeroplan points, a lifetime supply of Kraft dinner, Canadian tire money, syrup, Eggos, all the things. So all the cliches of Canada,
right,
the things that we roll our eyes at, are celebrated, but set against the backdrop of someone from another country explaining why being Canadian, the very thing that we take for granted, is the most important thing in the world to them and their family.
Sure.
I thought it was like, celebrate Canadianity, mock the cliches that we kind of roll our eyes at, but we're reminded at the end, well, you know, it still is a pretty awesome place to live. And it was met with, by the way, I know in my heart, that's a beautiful television show.
Yeah.
Equal parts syrupy and sappy. And it was met with, well, we can't make fun of people from other countries, that's racist. Which is like, okay, am I a terrible pitcher? Because that is not at all the portrait I was setting out to paint.
No, to me it sounds like, if anything, we're satirizing ourselves by taking a look at the tropes that we are tied to.
Isn't that what we do?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, how we identify ourselves. And don't get me wrong, I'm not the biggest fan of reality shows, but I like the idea of I like
you the, watch the Canadian.
I like the idea of, on a weekly basis, watching something that somebody identifies as uniquely Canadian. I like that idea of creating that world. Here's the Canadian, quote unquote, Canadian world that we are going to wrap around these new people who are coming to the country. I like that idea, because not only is it location every week, but it's the activity every week. Like, unlike something like The Amazing Race, where, hey, we're going to put you in this location and just have you get somewhere from here to here as fast as possible. In this case, you've actually wrapped them in Canadiana, and maybe that was part of the biggest pushback, is the fact that, oh, we can't be too Canadian.
Well, I think part of the challenge is, in Canada, they're looking for reasons to say no as opposed to reasons to say yes. And there are a myriad of reasons as to why that's the case. Right. In the States, they're looking for reasons to say yes, but the yes might be more of a, yes, we should really talk about the possibility of doing something like that someday.
Right.
But that's what we've discovered. Like, Taggart and Torrens asked people to define Canadianity, and it was so... from the macro, like just being friendly and nice, to the micro, like your beer league goalie arrives in the dressing room 5 minutes before you take the ice. People had very strong feelings about what Canadianity is. And when Rick Mercer won his Canadian Screen Award this past week, he said it's because 2 million people watch the show because it's unabashedly Canadian. We're not trying to be anything else. We're not trying to be fancy. We're just telling our stories. And there aren't enough outlets for that.
Yeah. Perhaps this is a good time for the section of the show that I like to call the beverage update. And
yeah.
And the beverage update, basically, when Diane and I first started the newsier side of the podcast every couple of weeks, she would always have four or five different beverages in front of her, including some obscure wine concoction and rooibos and stuff like that, and I tended not to have that exciting stuff. It's a sad, depressing... Well, I don't know. This is inherently Canadian. Speaking of inherently Canadian things, my beverage update... Because we're recording in the morning, which I don't often do. I'm more of a night hawk,
right.
But we're recording in the morning. This is going to sound really sad. I have half a cup of cold Tim Hortons hot chocolate in front of me from last night.
Cold hot chocolate.
Yes. It's just chocolate at this point. Chocolate liquid. And I
the movie Serendipity with John Cusack was based on a dessert place in New York called Serendipity, where they actually serve frozen hot chocolate.
Well, I wish I could say it was avant-garde enough to be frozen. It's not frozen. It's room temperature. It is not artisanal in any way. It is not drawn from the chocolatiers of Southern Murmansk or anything like that. Indeed, it is room temperature, tar-like chocolate in a cup. But I haven't rolled up the rim to win yet, so we'll wait and see what happens there.
Will we do that, like, on the podcast?
We could.
Remember a couple years ago when a kid had a hot chocolate and it rolled up the rim cup and he threw it out? And his classmate, who was a little girl, picked up the cup and she won a van?
Oh, yeah.
And it went to the courts. And the finder's keeper's rule was implemented because he'd thrown away a van. I think what happened ultimately is the two families split the van. Like, they sold the van and split the money. It was really the only way to play it.
Under the old Upper Canada law of Jeremy Finders and Leonard Keepers.
Yeah, you're right. Who could ever forget that landmark case?
Do you have a beverage?
In typical Canadian fashion, I am drinking a glass of melted snow, otherwise known as tap water.
You know, it wasn't artisanally drawn from anywhere. I'm just, you know, it just...
It wasn't.
Oh, geez.
No, and I'm pounding the dregs of coffee that I made a couple of hours ago when my three-year-old woke up.
Well, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, it's true.
It keeps you. It definitely keeps you awake. Now, one of the things I wanted to talk about is you've, more than a lot of people that I've talked to on this podcast who've, I think, been forced to stay near Toronto or Vancouver, you seem to have made as much as possible, an effort to try and remain back east.
And, I have.
And what are some of the struggles that you're facing in doing that? Obviously, is there always shows out there that you're going to be involved in, or is part of it, hey, by you being out there, you can hopefully help to bring some stuff out there?
The older I get, the more I realize knowing what you're not good at is as important as knowing what you're good at. When I lived in Toronto doing TorontoVision, I had a voice agent. I auditioned 300 times. I didn't book a single thing. I am not the type to walk into a room for an under five on Rookie Blue and blow the roof off the place. I'm just not.
Right.
When I was in the United States, I had a commercial agent. I have a newfound respect for folks that can drink Diet Sprite and look at the camera and beam. I look like a grade A Alberta a-hole doing that stuff. So there are a couple of things that are great about Nova Scotia. One is the cost of living is more manageable. So during the ebbs or flows, no matter how you look at it, it's easier to coast a little longer. And the second thing is when I moved back here from the States, which really was a lifestyle choice, I honestly thought there's nothing more important, there's no job better than living where I'm from. And if I have to go to Compu College or become a realtor, I guess that's that then. It just so happens, because I made a decision for the right reasons, that work has flourished here in ways beyond my wildest imagination. What are the odds that Fitz would be shot here? I had a one-day walk-on in season one and became a recurring regular, right, which was so fun. I did an episode of Seed. Mr. D happens to shoot here because it's the same producer, Mike Volpe, who produced Trailer Park Boys. His Top Sail Entertainment is based in Halifax. I did my own show here for TV Tropolis. It's not that I have committed to never going elsewhere. It just so happens that there's a lot going on here. And not only that, but I live outside of Truro, Nova Scotia, an hour from Halifax, which is now where Trailer Park Boys shoots. So when Trailer Park Boys came up again, this kind of redux, my first feeling was, I'm someone's dad wearing a do-rag for a living. I kind of feel like it's run its course. And I think the difference between a role and a career is you have to turn the page in this country. And Trailer Park came along at the perfect time after TorontoVision ended. Mr. D came along at the perfect time after Trailer Park. I felt it kind of run its course. But the reality is Trailer Park Boys shoots in Truro. I can sleep in my own bed every night. I get to direct some episodes now, and I'm in the writer's room. I would be foolish to not do it, especially because there's still a gigantic appetite for it.
I can imagine, like, when if you find out that a Canadian production is going on outside your back door, you're going to feel like, what the heck am I doing if I'm not there? If they've asked me to be there. You know, what do you do, get up
right,
every morning?
Right, they've asked me to, and the three guys, you know, they really bet the farm on, they bought the rights, as I'm sure you know from the original producers, they really bet the farm on the fact that having been out touring, they felt this is only just getting going. And they deferred fees in order to acquire the rights. They deferred fees to get season 8 made. There was no guarantee. There was no broadcaster. Nobody in Canada wanted it. And it was only then that the Netflix thing kind of timed out.
Right.
So kudos to them for having the nads that size, that they were that confident and sure of it, that they took that on. I'm more of a sure thing person and a bit more cautious by nature. So I've been trying to, you know, I've been having a few good years between Trailer Park and Mr. D. I've been trying to plan for the future. So I just bought a company where I rent trailers out to films and TVs.
Okay. So still with a lot of the contacts that you know in the industry, certainly that's got to be able to help. But you probably also, I would have to think that especially in some locations in Canada, a lot of that infrastructure service isn't necessarily easy to come by.
Well, this was really, I wasn't looking to get into the trailer business, but I'm very passionate about the East Coast and the industry here. What happens inevitably is we have a few good years, we have a few good crews, and then things get quiet and people lose their homes and the infrastructure is sold off. So this opportunity presented itself because my friend who owned the business wanted a lifestyle change, and I was afraid that these key pieces would be sold off across the country.
Right.
It's very important. I mean, if I want local Nova Scotia filmmakers and writers to be able to achieve their dreams, this infrastructure has to stay here. And one of the ways it can do that is because of the appealing tax credits and American Movies a Week and miniseries and things like that shoot here. And it would just be a shame if the reason that couldn't happen is because we didn't have the support vehicles. It's not. I never imagined a life in trucking.
Yeah, it sounds like you've become the guy at the party who's decided to get away from the crowd, go to another room, and then the room has one by one slowly followed you.
I wish it was that cool. And I also wish it was that calculated. This is not like all part of my master plan.
Oh, I think it is.
In my younger years, I was more punkish about the level of work people were doing or whether that was funny or if this was good. The truth is, if you make a living in the arts in Canada, you're in the 5% of folks that do.
Right.
So, as I said, if a show is doing well, that's great for everybody. So social media for me has become a place where I go to applaud the accomplishments of my peers and colleagues and in some cases rivals. I try to use what platform I have to promote things that are going on in Canadian TV, same as you guys do.
Yeah.
And without those things, we're not an industry. We're just a bunch of folks being jealous. And I think the only downside of being out here on the East Coast sometimes is that some people fall into a mentality where they think, well, I'm not even going to audition for that because they'll probably get someone from Toronto to come down here and do that. I did a feature several years ago in Newfoundland, and I overheard somebody saying, yeah, they'll probably get people from Halifax come over here to do that. So you can always find that wherever you are. It's a waste of energy and time to be jealous and wish things were different. You should just be putting that energy into trying to tread water and stay afloat.
Do you, at this point, having been through a lot of different aspects of the industry in terms of you've done some writing, directing, acting, where in your head, do you identify yourself as one of those things now? Or do you identify yourself as more of a cross list between all of them? I mean, and one of the reasons I'm asking that is because, so I'm reading a couple of the early articles that came out after hearing you won the award last night, and it lists you as comic.
Isn't that funny?
Well, and so when I first read that, I thought, well, I don't know that I would consider him a comic anymore. But when you kind of close your eyes and you think about what am I, other than taking some kind of existentialist, I am just me kind of thing. Has it been a long enough career now where it's just kind of some bizarre hybrid cross list?
Am I Seacrest or Schwimmer? Is that what you're asking?
No, I would never, never do that. Are you Lauren Green or are you...
Dare to dream. The most curious word in that entire question was anymore. I mean, I don't see you as a comic anymore. Do you think I used to be funny?
No, no. It's not
being funny now?
It's not about funny, but when I think of comic, I think of stand-up comic.
Same. I do too.
Yeah, and so...
And this is the first time I've ever... been referred to in that way. That's been one kick in reading these articles since, and the other kick has been the myriad of adjectives in which they describe Vice Principal Robert Cheely, who I play on Mr. D, like kooky, out there, weirdo. Those are always the characters that I play, and you know, on paper, J-Rock and Principal Cheely couldn't be much more different, but the truth is, they're both underqualified and overconfident, and that's kind of the wheelhouse I find really funny.
Right.
I guess my reluctance to self-identify as anything is that it might limit any future opportunities.
Right.
Like, the truth is, I have hosted to do traditional hosting, like straight, when we come back kind of hosting. Doesn't totally appeal to me, though I've done it.
Right.
I don't really consider myself an actor. I'm certainly not a stand-up comic. I don't know what I am, but I know that there's kind of...
Does entertainer encompass it these days? I don't know if that's even too broad. It sounds Scott Joplin-esque.
I would think Marty Short's an entertainer. Because Marty Short can actually, you know, put on the tap shoes and do a Broadway number.
Sure.
That's what I think when I think entertainer. I probably identify as a hustler more than anything. Because I've devised a three-tier system of criteria by which I run every possible job through.
Right.
Fun, money, challenge. I have to have any two of those. If it's a fun challenge and the money's no good, I don't care. But any time I've done something for just one of those, it's backfired.
I'm sensing a new pitch as the Halifax Hustler, by the way, just after hearing that.
You're sensing a new what?
A new pitch as the Halifax Hustler.
Yeah, the Halifax Hustler, that's right. I would say the commonality in most of the things that I've done is that they've been hybrids. Trailer Park Boys was a mockumentary. John O'Vision was a talk show with sketch. Street Sense was a consumer affairs show with parody and satire. The Joe Schmo Show was a fake reality show. Like, that seems to be, maybe that's why I keep fooling them.
Right. Definitely a lot of hard satire versus, and I would even say in Trailer Park Boys, one of the things that, when I started watching it, one of the things you realize right away, it's way more an element. There's some hardcore satire in there. Outside of the funny stuff, there's some hardcore satire about some things that we really don't want to look at about not just Canada, but I guess a whole lot of other places. But I mean, I think
it's interesting that.
Pardon me?
When it started airing on BBC America.
Yeah.
It was kind of before the mockumentary was a widely accepted format, thanks to The Office and shows like that.
Yeah.
But it was seen as a drama because so many people live like that in North America, especially, I mean, it being bleeped didn't help.
Right.
But it's interesting in just the short 10 or so years since it's started that that's so much more widely acceptable now. The thing that I love about Trailer Park Boys is nobody calls Bubbles disparaging words that we use in our society for folks with challenges. Nobody judges Randy and Leahy's relationship, nor do they call them disparaging words. It just is what it is.
Yeah.
And everybody in the park bands together when an external force comes in to try to threaten or take over, you know, and nobody's feeling sorry for themselves. Someone asked me recently if I felt sorry for J-Rock, and it had never occurred to me.
Well, when people start to when characters from shows start to become our quote unquote friends, become our quote unquote family, people we identify with, you don't use those names for people you know, and
right.
I think that it's a testament to the fact that, you know, when people have integrated those characters into their own lives, there's not even a consideration of saying that. Just like, you know, if you had a cousin who was that way, you're not going to start throwing that stuff at your cousin. But people are starting to identify, especially on a long-running show, these characters, they've integrated them into part of what they are. And And that's...
Like, what is Bubbles? What do you mean, what is Bubbles? He's just Bubbles.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
J-Rock, for example, he doesn't act black. He thinks he's black.
Yeah.
And nobody in the park pulls him aside and says, you're not black. They just accept him at face value. And I think that's the Clattenburg heart of it. But it does have a big beating heart. And he always said, you take away the guns, dope, and swearing, it's a show about family. And it really is.
One of the things that, as we're wrapping up here, one of the things that I always like to ask people is, for me, I know that so much of my worldview now has been determined by a lot of the stuff, the pop culture stuff that I absorbed while I was younger and growing up. For me, it's always been Saturday mornings watching cartoons as a kid. My mind keeps flashing back to that at least once a day. I think I'm thinking about, you know, at some point that nostalgic look of my favorite stuff growing up as a kid. I'm wondering if you have those kind of pop cultural touchstones that when you think back to television or film or music when you were growing up, the stuff that kind of still sticks with you today.
Mr. Dress Up, of course.
Yes. The only show where no one could say goodbye for themselves. They had to say goodbye for each other.
That's true. I had the chance to tour a bit with Ernie when I started on Street Senses, you know, CBC open houses and things like that. And I've never seen someone part the seas in an airport the way he did.
Right.
Guys in business suits, toddlers, homemakers, whoever, people just dissolved in his wake, and he remained befuddled and delighted and confused as to why people would react that way right till the very end. That was pretty cool. I'm not starstruck, but when I got to meet that guy, I certainly was. There was a show, I think it was out here, called Shantytown.
Okay.
It might have been on ATV, which is a CTV affiliate here, which is probably not a show you could get off the ground nowadays, about some puppets who lived in squalor. But it was a different time.
Puppets.
That's another show that, for whatever reason, sticks out.
I think that needs to be brought back on the web. Puppets and Squalor.
I don't know if you could even, like, I just remember they had like soot on their filthy face. It's like, it was, I don't know who thought it was a good idea.
It was like,
it was like Oliver.
Yeah, it was Oliver. It was.
Yeah.
Come on. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, it was.
Can I have some more?
Please, can I have some more? No, puppet. Back in the tent for you.
Puppets and Squalor. I just love that as the title. If you just changed it to Puppets and Squalor.
That's going to be the name of my autobiography. I thought it was going to be Has Been and Wife, but Puppets and Squalor is, if I was walking by Indigo and that was on the table, I'd be grabbing that.
And get someone to make a Muppet of you on the front
yeah.
cover.
Not to brag, but I have one.
Oh, wow. That's all. Do you have soot on it, though?
No, not yet. But the day is still early.
Anything coming up that we should be watching for?
Yeah. I just finished a show with Samantha Bee from The Daily Show.
Okay.
She and I play sports reporters, commenting on the every coming-of-age foible of a 14-year-old boy. It's a Norwegian format, but this will air on YTV. It's called Game On, and I think it bows in May.
Okay.
She and her husband, Jason Jones, have just sold 10 episodes of a sitcom to TBS, which is awesome. She's a great lady.
Yeah. Jason Jones is actually a Hamilton guy. Went to the high school that I taught at about 10 years ago, by the way.
Braggart.
Yeah, exactly. A name drop.
Does that count as a name drop? I think it does.
It counts.
But they're just a formidable pair.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because the sitcom that they're doing kind of tells the story of their life with a young family. So Jason's playing the father, and they've cast someone in the role of the mother. Samantha will not be playing herself.
Wow.
That'd be weird.
Yeah, I think so. So you've got that coming up, and I'm assuming from what you said earlier, always projects that you're pitching and always projects on the go. I just
finished a little sizzle reel called Mother Hunters about five women who work in typical traditional jobs, and on Friday they trade their 9-to-5 for a 308 because they're into providing all the food that their families ingest. So it's, I guess, in quotes, a reality show, but it's kind of more lifestyle docy. You just have to be open, man. I met them at the Truro Outdoor Home Show. They're the only all-female chapter of the Canadian Wild Turkey Federation.
Wow.
And I met them and said, I think this is a show. And they said, we think it's a show, too. And next thing I know, a week later, I'm out in the woods with Orange on.
Not only is it a show, but it's a show for the History Channel for some reason. I don't know why.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks so much to Jonathan Torrance for joining me on the TV ABC's podcast this week. And before I forget, I always miss doing this, but I want to thank people who have supported us on Patreon.com. It's Patreon.com, patreon.com/TV_EH. Now, I know that sounds like a long Earl to remember, but that's where you can go and click on the link. And if you want to contribute $1 per episode or just help keep sustain some of the business side of what we do with this podcast in terms of server space and all that, I do want to mention that we've currently got some new patrons. I'm going to mention a bunch of them that we got here. Thank you to Dennis McGrath, Kenna Mary McKinnon, Christopher White, Joyce David, Catherine Tom, Doug Slater, and Bram Abramson, all for being Patreons to this podcast. We really appreciate your contributions. Thank you so much for helping us bring some of these conversations to you and bring some of these stories to you about Canadian television. You can listen to all of the podcasts by going to the TV-EH.com website. You can go there and click on podcasts. You can hear all the other podcasts that I do by going to AnthonyMarco.com. You can find me on Twitter at AnthonyMarco and TVA on Twitter at TV_EH. Please get in touch and let us know what you think. And that wraps up another episode for this week. And now back to your regularly scheduled programs.